Greetings and welcome to the OU.org and at Shalom.com podcast of Sefer Shmuel as part of the OU's wonderful Nach Yomi program. We are beginning at the very beginning of Sefer Shmuel. My name is Yitzchak at Shalom, and I'm honored to be sharing this platform with some esteemed teachers. And looking forward to an enjoyable, engaging, and stimulating opportunity to study Torah together with you via the wonderful technology of podcasting over the course of the next couple of months as we make our way through Sefer Shmuel. A few introductory notes. Sefer Shmuel, which follows Sefer Shoftim, does not necessarily follow in the same way that Shoftim follows Yoshua. Because in the beginning of Shoftim, the text identifies the events at the end of Yoshua as being the premise and the background against which the beginning of Sefer Shoftim happens. Such is not the case with Shmuel. And indeed, it is very unclear if the end of Sefer Shoftim, if the last few stories, are stories that happened really at the end of that period or happened earlier on. It seems from the presence of Pinchas in the war in chapter 20 of Sefer Shoftim that those are events that took place earlier on. And that may have a lot to do with the way that we understand Sefer Shmuel and some of the allusions and implications of the stories in Sefer Shmuel, because indeed the end of Shoftim is set up to prepare us for Sefer Shmuel, and some of the stories in Sefer Shmuel are there to, if you will, resolve tensions that are raised in Shoftim. So a very quick review of the last five chapters of Shoftim, which the dedicated listeners of the OU Nach Yomi will certainly remember as being very recently taught. The last five chapters of Sefer Shoftim are comprise two stories, the story of Pesel Micha and the story of Pilegash B'Givah, both stories which highlight how very terrible things were during the entire period, and which have as an anthemic banner statement, "Bayamim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael, ish ha'yashar b'inav yaseh," which is indeed the last verse in Sefer Shoftim. In those days, and there was no king in Israel, everyone was doing what was right in his eyes, and judging from those stories, pretty much everyone was doing things that were bad for everyone else, but right in their own eyes. I'm not going to review the stories themselves, except when we get to passages in Shmuel in which the references or the allusions are needed in order to make the point. However, the conclusion of Sefer Shoftim leaves us clearly interested in seeing the reversal of the status of that time. Ein Melech B'Yisrael, so we are expecting Melech B'Yisrael. And that is something that we will look forward to in Sefer Shmuel, and indeed that is a central, perhaps the central theme of the book. It's the book of anointment, it's the book of monarchy. Sefer Shmuel begins as follows. Vahi ish achad min haramatayim tzofim mihar Ephraim, ushmo alkanah ben Yerucham ben Elihu ben Tochu ben Suf Ephrati. You take a look at this opening pasuk, and we immediately notice several things that are strange about it. The first thing is that we are introduced to a man, but the man's name is not given at the beginning. We're told several things about this man. He lives in Ramatayim Tzofim, a town that we've never heard of before and a town that we'll never hear of again. We're told that this town is on Har Ephraim, Mount Ephraim, which is in the Shomron. And then we are told his name, and we're given extraordinarily long lineage for this man. His name is Elkanah, and we're told that his father is Yerucham, and his father was Elihu, and his father was Tochu, and his father was Tzuf, five generations back. And then, concluding the Pasuk, we are told that he is an Ephrati. Now, what does Ephrati mean? This is a subject of much discussion, and truth is that we could devote the entire session today, which will probably be about 45 minutes, to just solving this Pasuk, but we won't do so. But the problem of the word Ephrati is as follows. If we're to claim that Ephrati means, as it means in several places, for instance in Shoftim Perak Yudbet, that Ephrati means somebody from Shevet Ephraim, well, first of all, that seems to be already mentioned in the first half of the Pasuk, that this man is from Har Ephraim. But one could then argue, now, Har Ephraim is the geographic location. I don't yet know that he's from Shevet Ephraim, and therefore Ephrati tells me that. What's an example of someone being called an Ephrati? Besides in Shoftim Yudbet, the people who could not say Good Sabbath, Sibolet, and they were killed, the 42,000 members of Ephraim, Ephratiata. We also have Yoravam ben Nevat, who is an Ephrati, he's from Shevet Ephraim. But that becomes difficult because when we look at Divrei Hayamim Aleph Perek Vav and the lineage of the Leviim, bringing us to the Leviim who David appointed to be the singers in the Mikdash, we find that this entire family is families of Leviim, not families of Ephraim, which means that it's difficult to explain Ephrati as being from Ephraim. So what does Ephrati actually mean? To say that it means it's somebody from Har Ephraim, which is something the Radak suggests, is again difficult because we already said that this man's from Har Ephraim. So the Radak continues and says that Ephrati perhaps means that Tzuf was from Har Ephraim. In other words, Elkanah is from Har Ephraim, and that is a family that has been there for at least five generations, and that Tzuf is from Har Ephraim. There's a little bit more to recommend this, because as we will learn later in our parak and throughout Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel's home is in a place called Ramah. Now, Ramah is a name of a town in Israel of which there are quite a few. There is Ramat Ephraim, there is Ramat Binyamin, there is Ramat Lehi, there are several places called Ramah. And Ramah usually refers to a town which is on a high mountain. For instance, Ramat Binyamin is found right just north of Yerushalayim in the Arab town of Aram, which when you drive out of Yerushalayim, you could see it's a very high mountain with a steep slope to go up to the village. So he comes from a place called Ramah. It's clearly Ramat Ephraim because it's from Har Ephraim. So why is it called Ramatayim Tzofim? So Professor Yehuda Elitzur suggested once that it is that the area is called Ramatayim Tzofim, the town is called Ramatayim Tzofim in honor of Elkanah's illustrious ancestor, Tzuf, who evidently was a pretty important person, and as a result the area is named in his honor, and the town, which is usually called Ramah, is occasionally referred to as Ramatayim Tzofim. There is support for this theory because later on in Perek Tet, when Shaul, who we will meet in that chapter, goes searching for his father's donkeys, the text tells us that he goes through Eretz Shalim and through Eretz Tzuf, and when he's in Eretz Tzuf, he then is told by his lad, there is a man of God in the town of Ramah here. So clearly Ramah of Shmuel is in the land of Tzuf. And so that may be associated with this ancestor. That also may explain the reason why we're given such a long lineage to bring us all the way back to the illustrious Tzuf, who was so significant and who was evidently the pioneer who settled on Har Ephraim. So then one might ask, so where did this pioneer come from? So Professor Elitzur answers very sharply. He says, from Ephrat. In other words, he left Ephrat, which is otherwise known as Beit Lechem. Beit Lechem, he Ephrat. Beit Lechem Yehuda. And he left there to go north. And the reason that this is significant on the heels of Sefer Shoftim is if we look at both of those terrible, tragic stories at the end of Sefer Shoftim, we notice that they involve people who leave, and in both cases Leviim, who leave Beit Lechem to go north and seem to be leaving the civilized area to go to the, what we might call in contemporary words, the Wild West, or as it were, the Wild North of Har Ephraim, where things are lawless and where there is a true anarchy going on. Here we're given a different picture, that here's a Levi family that left Ephrat, went north to Har Ephraim, settled in, and has made a positive impact on the place, so we are already ready, as we begin the Sefer, to find things going in a much, much different direction. All right, now we meet the family. Now, important to note that at the beginning of any story, and this is as true in Tanakh, if not truer, than in other forms of Lahavdil, secular literature, the beginning of the story is presented with what we would call the exposition. Who are the players? What's the background? What's the location? What do they do for a living? What's their relationship? And then we're brought into the specific story. This is true in so many of the stories that we read in Sefer Bereishit, and it is true here. So the first thing we're told is about the man, his ancestors, and where he lives. V'lo shtei nashim, and now we're introduced to his two wives, which of course all of us reading this story and having memories of Sefer Bereishit, when we hear about a man having two wives, we already anticipate trouble and difficulties because, of course, Rachel and Leah. V'lo shtei nashim, shem achat Chana v'shem hashenit Pnina. They both have beautiful names. Chana, from Chen, charm, and Pnina, which is, of course, a jewel. V'yihi l'Pnina yiladim u'lechana in yiladim. So we are told now that Pnina had children and Chana did not have children. Now, if you notice the structure of this verse, it immediately tells you something about the family dynamic, the family politic, and is going to set the scene for the very dramatic encounter in Shiloh that will take place in a few verses. And that is as follows. We are introduced to two wives. Who is the main wife here? Who is the wife that we really put our attention on? Well, of course, we, as the ever-wise readers who already know the end of the story, are putting all of our attention on Chana. But that's not the way to read Tanakh. The way to read Tanakh is to read it, as Rashi says, quoting the Sifri, on the Pasuk, Vayu Advarim Ha'ela Asher Anochim Etzav Chahayom, Hayom Yu V'necha Kacharashim. Today, when you read it, it should be like a new thing. And that doesn't just mean that you should be excited, like something that you've just now received for the first time. It also means that to appreciate and understand Tanakh, you have to read the story as if you don't know how it's going to turn out. You don't know where the suspense is going to be resolved. You don't know whether Yaakov and Yosef ever will be reunited. You don't know really what's going to happen. Is Moshe going to accept the task, or is Aaron going to be the one to go? That suspense, that lack of knowledge that, of course, in the end, we all know how it's going to play out, because we've read the story so many times, allows us to fully appreciate all of the nuances of the text that raise our sensitivity to the various possibilities. And so here, when we ask the question, who is the main wife, all we know is there's Chana and there's Pnina. Chana is introduced first. So my gut reaction would be to say, oh, Chana, she must be the main wife. Chana and then Pnina. But then what happens? Vayihi Pnina yiladim u'lechana ein yiladim. We are told that Pnina had children and Chana did not have children. That in and of itself may not finish the job. After all, we know that Yaakov was married to Rachel and Leah, and for a significant time Leah had children and Rachel did not. And nonetheless, Rachel was certainly the main wife, as is evidenced by so many passages in Bereishit. Ve'uvnei Rachel eshet Yaakov, which is not a term used in the case of Leah. So we would have every reason to think that Chana perhaps is the main wife here. Nonetheless, look at the text. The text says, one of them was Chana, then Pnina. Pnina had children, Chana did not have children. In other words, we have an order of Chana, Pnina, Pnina, Chana. In other words, we have a structure which we refer to as a chiasmus, A-B-B-A, which appears so often in Tanakh and always serves to highlight the middle. In other words, the edges, in this case Chana on both sides, serve to highlight and to spotlight the middle, which is Pnina. Pnina indeed is the main wife, because Pnina is the one with children, Chana does not have children. Now, V'ala ha'ish ahu me'iro miyamim yamima, l'shtachavot v'lizboach l'adonai tzva'ot b'shilo. This man, now the Allah here doesn't mean he went up, it means he would go up. And it's describing a yearly thing, that this man would go up from his city, from year to year, to bow down and to bring a korban to Hashem in Shiloh. V'sham shnei v'nei Eli chofni ufinchas kohanim l'adonai. And we find out that in Shiloh, there are two boys, chofni ufinchas, who are kohanim to Hashem. We'll have to talk about that in a moment. But first, we'll take a look at this fellow, meaning Elkanah's, yearly trip to Shiloh. Shiloh is not all that far from Ramat Ephraim, a matter of a few hours walking with a family. But here we're told that once a year, Elkanah would go with his family and take them to Shiloh to bring a korban, to prostrate before Hashem, and to worship. And that was his yearly custom. The sense we get later on is that that was a common thing for people to have a yearly pilgrimage with the family. Zevach Hayamim. However, the mention of Hofni and Pinchas in this pasuk is very strange, because they do not play a role at all in this chapter. Eli, their father, plays a very critical role, but they are not mentioned again. And their real starring moment, which is an antagonistic starring moment, is in the next chapter, when we see how dastardly and how abusive they are. But in this chapter, they don't show up at all. So why are they mentioned here at all? It seems to me that there is a contrast being set up. Not really a contrast, but an apposition set up. Because who are the characters that we hear about who live in Ramat Haim and Sofim? We hear about Elkanah, Chana, Pnina. Elkanah, Chana, Pnina. A man and his two wives. Pnina has children. Those children play no role whatsoever. We don't know their names. Elkanah, Chana, Pnina. Who is in Shiloh? Eli, Hofni, Ufinchas. And here, Elkanah and Eli. Of course, Eli is with an ayin. But on the other hand, you have Chana and Pnina. And you have Hofni, Ufinchas. Names that sound very much alike. Chet and Pei, Chet and Pei. And you get the sense that the text is drawing for some sort of attention, some sort of a balance between the three characters in Ramah and the three characters in Shiloh. And we will see that our entire chapter will be devoted to a sense of tension between Shiloh and Ramah, which of course will culminate in the tension felt by Chana herself about whether to keep her newborn, Shmuel, in Ramah or to bring him to Shiloh, where she has promised to deliver him to Eli and to deliver him to Hashem. Vahi Hayom. And now we're taken from the exposition, the present, the background, to a particular day, a day in which they're in Shiloh. Vahizbach Elkanah, and he brought the korban, v'natam lifnina ishto ulucho banah uvnoteha manot. And he gave Pnina and all of her children portions of meat. Mana is a portion of meat. In other words, he brought the korban. By the way, parenthetically, where would they eat the korban? The korban is eaten, the halacha very clearly states in Masechet Megillah, in Mishnah Megillah, that it's also in the Sugya at the end of Zevachim, that korbanot are eaten, shlamim are eaten in Yerushalayim, lifnim min hachoma. That korbanot are eaten within the walled city. But in Shiloh, they are eaten b'chol haro'eh. From any spot from where you can see the Mishkan, at that spot you can eat korbanot. Which means that any place that you could sit and from there see the Mishkan, and from there to the Mishkan, you could walk and never be out of sight of the Mishkan, you can bring your korban to that spot and eat. Well, if you have visited the dig at Shiloh, where the location of the Mishkan is, you see that it is at the, sort of at the valley. And when you go into modern day Shiloh, you go into the road, and there's a turnoff to go straight and go to the dig, or to go up that steep hill into the village. But the ancient place of Shiloh, was at the bottom of the hill, and there are hills that ring it, which means there's almost a natural amphitheater, a very large amphitheater, of area in which you could sit and always be in view of the Mishkan, of the site of the Mishkan. A number of years ago, I was hiking with a friend of mine, Zev Erlach, known as Jabbo, up in the hills around Eli, and we stood and looked down at the Mishkan and reviewed the halacha, and Jabbo said to me, he said, after all, could you sit here and eat the korban? I said, sure, b'chol haro'eh. He said, okay, here's a problem. You are bringing a korban to Shiloh. You want to come up here to get a very nice view and bring your korban up. You walk up and up and up and up, and then you take one step too far, and suddenly you're out of range. So it's a big problem. He said, okay, you're on the religious council of Shiloh. How do you solve the problem? So I said, my gut reaction was, well, you build a wall, or you put some sort of a marker and tell people you can't go beyond this. He said, very good. Okay, now you're in Shomron. What do you build the wall out of? I said, stones. It's the Shomron. Of course you can build with stones. He said, good, come over here. And he uncovered the remains of a wall that he had discovered that goes around a good part of that perimeter that he maintained, and written an article about 10 years ago, maintained was a wall that was constructed exactly for that purpose, to make sure that people would know how far they could go with their korban and still be in sight of the Mishkan. In any case, an interesting aside. So Elkanah brought the korban, and he brought meat to Chana, to Pnina and her children. Evidently, the simplest way to read this is that he gave Chana a double portion. Why? Ki at Chana ahev, v'adunai sagar rachma. Because he loved Chana, and the vav before Shem Hashem doesn't mean and Hashem, but rather it's what we call conversive vav, vav hanigud, but Hashem had closed her womb. In other words, even though Elkanah loved her, nonetheless Hashem had closed her womb, and in spite of that he gave her a double portion. And parenthetically, we hear about a tense relationship between Chana and Pina, and the previous pasuk may be a little bit of a glimpse into the purpose. The reason for that is that it may indeed be that Pina was jealous of the fact that Chana was getting this extra attention. V'chiasata tzarata gam kas, her tzara, her co-wife, angered her. Bavur harima, in order to upset her, ki sagar Adonai be'ad rachma. And according to Midrash Chachamim, what that means is that Pina would tease her about the fact that she didn't have children. It was a machloket, a dispute among the Mefarshim, as to whether Pina was doing this out of pettiness or she was doing this really for a noble reason to try to promote and provoke Chana to be so upset that she would go and pray, which is indeed how things play out. So, as it were, the jury is still very much out on Pina. And now we're told that everything we just read is not something that happened once. This is what would happen every year. And so you can imagine for years now, the pilgrimage to Shiloh was something that was very painful for Chana. On the one hand, you're coming to this place of sanctity and this place of spiritual loftiness to bring a korban. On the other hand, it's a family outing, a family event in which your childlessness is becoming the source of extra pain. And Pina would anger her every year, and she wept and did not eat. Whether it means that Chana did not eat anything, or whether it means that she did not eat any of the meat of the korban because she felt she was too sad to, or it just means she didn't eat as much. In any case, it was not a happy time for her. Vayomer la Elkana isha, and Elkana then comes to her and says the following: Chana lama tivki v'lama lo tochli v'lama yira levavech. Notice it says lama lama lama. And to be honest, Elkanah, although he may mean well, sounds like he's kind of whining. Why aren't you joining the rest of us? Why are you upset? Why are you so sad? Why aren't you eating? And then he really demonstrates what seems to be a real lack of sensitivity to her situation. And he says to her, "Halo, anochi tov lach me'asara banim. After all, am I not better to you than 10 sons?" In other words, as if to say, the fact you don't have children, but you've got me. Which, of course, is very insensitive on the part of her husband, to think that having a good husband is a replacement for having children, which, of course, is Chana's great, great desire and great need. So it does not work. This is, of course, a phrase borrowed from the women who are standing at the bed of the newborn that Rut has just given birth to in the fourth chapter of Megillat Rut, where they are creating a relationship between Rut and Naomi, which is really a non-existent relationship, in order that this be considered Naomi's grandchild. And the way that they justify that is to say, because after all, your daughter-in-law, who loves you more than 7 children, is the mother of this child. So in other words, they're saying, Ruth is kind of like your daughter because she's greater than any 7 sons could be, and therefore this is sort of your grandchild. But that phrase, which is a very powerful phrase in Ruth here, certainly does ring hollow. In any case, Chana continues. And Vatakum Chana achare ochla v'shilo v'achare shato. So what did she do after eating and drinking? Whether that means she drank or not, Midrash Chachamim is it means after the drinking, but not her drinking, because drinking almost always in Tanakh refers to wine. Ve'eli ha'kohen yoshev al kisei al mezuzah techal Adonai. And Eli was sitting on a chair right next to the doorpost on the way into the Mishkan. Now, we would assume that Elkanah was the one who brought the korban in to be offered, and for the blood part of the Zukat Amim. But then afterwards, the rest of the family, who never got close, went with him to whatever part of the hill or whatever it is to sit down and eat the korban. She now comes into the Mishkan, and Eli is sitting there watching. Now, Eli watching means that he's not asked acting as an officiant, which may indeed be what Chofni and Pinchas are doing, if there's anything going on at this present time. But she comes in. V'hi marat nafesh. Chana is very upset. V'atitpalel al Adonai uvachotivke. Chachamim, at the beginning of the fifth parak of Brachot and the Bavli, make much about the fact that the preposition here is al Hashem, but not el Hashem. She prayed not to Hashem, but she prayed sort of concerning Hashem, or almost at Hashem. And Chachamim add in to Chana's words almost veiled threats that she threatens God with if he does not accede to her request for a child. Fascinating piece. The interested reader should take a look on Daf Lamed Aleph in Masechet Brachot. And she davened uvachotivken, she wept. Vatidor neder, and then she took a vow. Vatomar, Adonai Tzvot, imraoti reba oni amatacha, if you see the pain and the affliction of your maidservant, meaning me, uzchartani velo tishkachat amatacha, remember and don't forget me, evoking, of course, Yosef's words to the Sar Mashkim. Venatatala matcha zera nashimin, give me seed of men, and it's children. I will give him back to you for his entire life. And he will not have a razor go on his head. In other words, I will consecrate him as a Nazir. Now, what's interesting about this is that the result of this neder, of course, we know is Shmuel. And Shmuel is delivered to Hashem, but we never again hear about Shmuel's Nazirut as a significant point. Where is this coming from? Why is Chana making this offer? Well, the one model that she could possibly be connecting with is the model of Eshet Manoach in Perek Yud Gimel of Shoftim, chapter 13 of Shoftim, in which Eshet Manoach is promised that even though she is barren, she is going to have a child, and that child will save Am Yisrael. And she's also told that the child, that she has to avoid wine and grapes, and she has to make sure that the child doesn't have a razor go over his head, because he's going to be a Nazir. So it's almost as if Chana is saying, well, if that worked there to solve the problem of the barrenness, then maybe if I make that offer as part of my neder, then it will work here. So she's making the offer of returning him to Hashem and of being a Nazir. Vayakir batali palel lifnei Adonai, and she continued to daven. So in other words, we don't know the words of her tefillah. It's important to note. We do not know what she said when she davened, which is entirely appropriate. And as the Gemara makes the point in Brachot, that her lips moved, but you could not hear her voice, as we'll see in the next couple of psukim, and that's why Eli thought what he did, which we'll see forthwith, but her tefillah is her business between her and Hashem. We know that she took a vow within the context of the tefillah, and the words of the vow were given explicitly. So she continued to daven, Ve'eli shomer piha. Eli is watching her. He's watching a woman who came in, and she's obviously very intent. Whether she's shaking back or forth or not, I don't know. But she's obviously very intent. And as we see in the next pasuk, Chana hi medaberet al liba, rak sfateha na'ot v'kola lo yishamea. So she's speaking on her heart, meaning that her lips are moving, but you can't hear any voice. Ve'achshiveha Eli l'shikora. And Eli, I would say quite naturally, but that's not so obvious, thinks her to be a drunken woman. Because after all, you see this woman walk up, you don't hear a word coming out of her, she's very intent, and you hear, you see her lips moving, but you don't hear any sound. Looks like a crazy woman, looks like a drunk woman. Now remember, Eli is sitting there as families come for the korbanot, and as part of their eating the korbanot later, they are also having some wine. So it's not a totally irrational or unfounded conclusion to think this woman is drunk. But it also indicates that Eli does not recognize what sincere tefillah would look like, because he doesn't even give that a possibility in his considerations. He immediately assumes her to be drunk and speaks her to her that way. Vayomer Eli, an matai tishtakarin. Literally, how long will you be drunk for? Meaning, stop it. Hasirit yenech me'alayich. You know, go get a cup of coffee. You know, just go sleep it off. Get rid of your wine. Don't be in here. Atan chana v'tomer lo adoni. She speaks back to him, which itself is quite remarkable. He's the Kohen Gadol. He's the chief officiant in the Mishkan. And this woman who's of no special standing that we hear, she's married to somebody who seems like an important guy, but that's it. And she's got no kids. She speaks to him and says, Lo aduni, ishak shat ruach anochi. I'm a very bitter and strong woman. V'yan v'shechar lo shatite, I don't drink wine. In other words, I'm a depressed person, I don't drink wine, I don't celebrate like that. V'ashpocha nafshi lefnei adonai, what I was doing here was I was pouring my heart out before Hashem. That's what you saw. Al titen et amatcha lefnei bat b'lial. Don't treat me like I'm some sort of, don't think of me like I'm some sort of a low person. Bat b'lial. K'mirov sichi mirov v'chasidi barti anhena. Here, the word siach, which normally means talking, can't mean that because it doesn't make sense in the context, and by parallelism, it's related to the word kas. So it must be because of all of my anxiety and upsetness, this is why I talk the way I did. So it's not because I'm drunk, I'm totally aware of what I'm doing, I'm sober, however, I'm very, very upset and very anxious and filled with anxiety, and that's why this happened. Vayan Eli vayomer l'chi l'shalom. So Eli accepts the rebuke, and he recognizes that he had seen wrong. V'lohi Yisrael tenet shelatecha she'sha'alt me'imo. And he says, Hashem should grant you the request that you gave. But notice how cleverly the word she'latech is written. Eli, we would have to assume, had no idea what she was praying for, because after all, he didn't hear the words. On the other hand, here's a woman who was clearly a married woman, you could tell perhaps by her association, by her dress, and it's a woman who is praying with great intensity. One of the most reasonable conclusions would be is that she's praying for a child. So it's not impossible to think that he had figured out what she was praying for. But notice what he says. He says, Hashem should give your she'latech, should give she'latech. Now, she'latech should be written with an aleph. She'elatech, your request. Instead, it's written without an aleph, kind of alluding to the idea of a shilya, meaning a placenta, a child. And cleverly with that missing aleph, and we're not saying that Eli necessarily said it this way, but b'nevuah, when the Sefer was written, it was written that way as if to say that Eli already had an inkling as to what she was praying for. Hashem should give you the baby that you've asked for, but really the request that you asked for. And of course, what word is already coming in here? Sha'al, sha'al, sha'alt me'imo, she'ilatech. Alright, v'atomer te'em tzimtza shivchatra chen be'inecha. And what does Chana say back to Eli? I hope that I find favor in your eyes. Now she went back and she ate. And she no longer had the same face, meaning she had a glum face, an upset face. Now she went there and Eli gave her a nice bracha. Hashem should grant you what you wanted, or perhaps Hashem should grant you the child. And now she was able to eat and things were fine. So this clearly is a new year and a year in which things are turning differently. So what happened? They got up early in the morning. So they evidently went back to the Mishkan and prostrated themselves. And then they went back. And they went back to their house in Ramah. In other words, they would come one day and have a korban, and they would sleep over in the area of Shiloh. That's part of the pilgrimage experience, Lina. And the next morning, say goodbye, as it were, prostrate themselves and leave. And they left, and they came back to Ramah. Vayeda Elkanah t'chana ishto vayizkereha Adonai. And Elkanah had relations with his wife, and now Hashem remembered her. And this is where Chazal pick up on vayizkereha, and connecting it with the word pakad, which shows up at the end of Perek Bet, that Chana has more children, and says that connects us with the word of pakad, and from there Chachamim come to the conclusion, because this is called Yom HaZikaron, is what we call Rosh Hashanah, that on Rosh Hashanah both Sarah and Chana were remembered and were blessed to have children. It happened after seasons, which Midrash Chachamim is that this refers to 2 months and 2 days. So according to the Shmuel, was an excessive preemie. But Chana became pregnant, she had a son. Vatikra et shmo Shmuel. What did she call him? She called him Shmuel. Why? Ki mi Adonai she'iltiv. I asked of him from God. The Radak explains that Shmuel is a compound of, a conflation of two words, sha'al me'el. I asked him, I requested him from God. And therefore it becomes Shmuel. Vayal ha'ish al kana v'chol beito, lizboach l'Adonai et zevachemim v'et nidro. And now, Elkanah, came the time, Shmuel was born, it came the time for him to go for the yearly pilgrimage and to pay back his neder. Now, what does his neder mean? There are three different ways to understand this, and we should put all three of them out. Way number one is that his regular pilgrimage included an offering that was part of a neder. Every year he took a neder, I'm going to bring this offering, a vow, bring this offering. Second possibility is that he had taken some sort of a neder during the year, and when he was going to Shiloh, he was going to pay it off. It was a particular offering. But the third possibility, which may help understand the next couple of psukim, is that, after all, Chana had taken a vow. And the vow was that if you give me a son, I'll give him back to you. Well, the vow of a wife, from the perspective of Tanakh, and from within a particular context within Chazal's world, is something that the responsibility ultimately devolves upon the husband. And therefore, a husband has to be careful. If his wife takes in darim, he may indeed be held culpable for it. Klape shamayim, towards God. And therefore, it could be that Chana's vow to bring Shmuel up becomes Elkanah's vow. So when he says, I'm going to go up to Shiloh to bring the korban and pay the vow, that means to bring Shmuel. So what happens? Chana lo alata. Chana didn't go up. Kamra l'isha, what did she say to her husband? Ad yigamel hanar v'aviyoti v'nirat pnei Adonai v'yashav sham arulam. I'm going to wait until the boy is weaned. And then I'll bring him up, and he'll see Hashem's face, and then he'll stay there forever. Meaning, once I bring him to Shiloh, I can't take him back. And he's too young for me to take him now and to separate from him. Now, this is always a quandary. No woman mother wants to separate from her child, especially a young child. But, on the other hand, that was her vow. And so, therefore, she says, I'll wait until he's weaned. The question is she going to wait until the first possible moment to wean him, or is she going to hang on to him extra long? Is her interest here one of doing the right thing for the son, or is it, I want to hold on to him longer? So therefore, Elkanah comes with the following response. Vayomer la Elkanah isha, asi hatov beinayich. You do what's right in your eyes. Shvi ad gom leichoto. Now notice, he changes the words a little bit. He says, stay here until you wean him. Not until he's weaned. In other words, don't leave it up to him to decide when he's finished. You wean him, and which of course it will speed it up a little bit more. Achya came out tonight dvaro, and God will indeed fulfill his word. And so she did exactly what Elkanah said. She continued to nurse him until she weaned him, and then it was time to go up. She came up, and she brought with her, befarim shlosha, befachat kemach v'nevel yain. And by the way, you do not hear that Elkanah came with her. But she obviously had some slaves and servants and animals, pack animals to carry these things. She brought three cows and one ephah, which is approximately 30 kilograms. It's a large amount of flour. And one flask of wine. These are all gifts to bring to the Mishkan with Shmuel. And she brought him to the Mishkan in Shiloh, and the boy was a boy. Unclear whether the second word nar there is some sort of a verb that the boy acted like a boy, or it means he was still a boy. In any case, vayishchatu atapar. Now, there's something difficult about this word. We said that she brought up three oxen. And then it says, and they slaughtered the ox. The ox, of course, is singular. Vayishchatu et hapar. Why is that? Vayavir tanar elili. So evidently, even though she brought three parim up, three oxen up, one of them was part of the ceremony of handing Shmuel over. And so they shechted the par, the ox, and handed Shmuel over to Eli. The rest were offerings that were going to be brought separately. Now, vatomer. Bialuni, and she turns to Eli and uses the same wording that she used a few years earlier. Please, my master, Bialuni is short for Biani Aduni Ha'avon, which shows up one time in our Sefer in Perek Hafei, which means, please excuse me, the fault is mine. It's a protocol, a way of speaking to a king or to a person of high rank. Achenav Shecha Aduni, she swears by his life. Ani Ha'ishai in Sevetim Chabazeh, I'm the woman who is standing right here next to you, the Palel El Adonai. I was the one who was standing here davening to Hashem. She's trying to remind him about the woman who he thought was drunk. And now she points to Shmuel and says, that's what I was davening for. I was praying for that. I was praying for that boy. And notice what she says. She says, and Hashem gave me my request that I requested of him. And then she continues. And then she says, and I'm lending him back to Hashem. He's on loan to Hashem for his whole life. And then she prayed to Hashem. Now notice how she uses the word, first of all, Shaul, which is associated with Shmuel, Sha'almiel, but of course is foreshadowing Shaul, the next significant character in her book. But besides that, notice what she's done. At the beginning, she says, I have asked him of Hashem, and Hashem gave me my request. And then she turns around and says, and I am lending him to Hashem. Implication being that up until now, Hashem gave him to me. It was Hashem's that he lent to me. My lending him back to Hashem is a statement of ownership. He's mine. You don't lend somebody something that's not yours. I'm lending him to Hashem means she's now taken possession. She is now the mother of this child, and she is agreeing to lend him to Hashem as per her earlier agreement. And then she bowed to Hashem, and of course, she hasn't yet left, because she's going to offer up a great tefillah, with which we will begin the next shiur tomorrow as we continue in our study of Sefer Shmuel. Everybody should have a wonderful day.